issues this year at 8:30.
Whoa.
Good morning, colleagues, members of the audience. I'm going to call to order today's meeting. We are May 29, 2013. This is the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. We have a public hearing, possible work session to start off, and then look forward to a very interesting discussion of remediation in our higher education system. So I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 782, which came over to us a couple of weeks ago. And colleagues, just a little bit of background, and then we have a number of people who have signed up to speak to this bill. 782, you might remember when we had our hearing on House Bill 3115, which had to do with apprenticeship in the state. We heard from Mr. Rakowitz from AGC that there was a bill, a cooking over on the Senate side, to deal with apprenticeship. And that was Senate Bill 782, which, as I said, found its way over here. It was immediately made clear to me that this was going to be, on our side, a very controversial bill. And so I asked a number of people to come together and to look at what parts of this bill we could agree to and what maybe not. Certainly, everyone agreed that this was an issue worth pursuing. The idea that if the state had an interest in setting an apprenticeship standard for its public works projects, then we needed, at the very least, to sit down and figure out how to get there. And so I would say that everybody agreed that some sort of work group process was in order. We also talked about how about if we set an aspirational goal of 10%? 10% seemed to be a starting figure that most people could agree to. It was what you may remember, we put a 10% figure into the I-5 replacement bridge project bill, and so there was some interest in that. So what came of that then, out of that meeting, was a set of amendments which we just received yesterday and you just received yesterday, that what it does is it says that the state believes that it's in its interest to have a standard, a 10% minimum standard for apprenticeship for all of the projects that our agencies are doing, and that would come into effect starting in July of 2014. However, there were a number of questions about, how do we assure compliance with that? And what kind of path does that set up for future work on this issue? A lot of people felt that 10% was a good starting point, but perhaps we should that should be higher. Washington State has a 15% minimum. Can we perhaps over time move to that? So that there was talk about that being something that would need to be worked out. You may recall that House Bill 3115 had a holdback feature, where contractors would not get their full amount if they didn't meet the apprenticeship goals. Senate Bill 782, as it came over to us, used a different methodology where there was a kind of $20 per hour bonus for meeting. And both of those, believe it or not, were very controversial with some groups. Some groups loved one approach, others hated it. And so the disincentives would need to be worked out, et cetera, et cetera. So what the amendments did was, what they do is set the standard beginning July 2014, call for an immediate convening of a work group to work on the compliance issues so that it's not just left up to DAS to decide, okay, how do we assure that the public interest is maintained, but rather have the stakeholders involved and seeing what we can come up with. And that, in a nutshell, is what we have here in the amendments to 782. Before opening a work session and asking for these amendments to be adopted, I want to hear from, we have a number of people in the room who, would like to speak. Some will probably be inclined to talk about the original bill. I would really encourage you to focus on the amended bill. But I will have to ask you to keep your comments short. If we could keep testimony at around 3 minutes or so, I'd really appreciate it. So I'm going to call up first John Rakowitz and Tom Girding. Please come up. And as you're coming up, gentlemen, I do want to thank you for the work that you've done on this bill. Taking the issue of apprenticeship seriously and moving this forward.
Good morning. Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, my name is John Rakowitz. I'm with AGC, Associated General Contractors. I have submitted, for the record, a letter. I hope you all have received that now. It looks like it's coming around. Dated May 17th, addressed to Chair Dimbrough, following the stakeholder work group he just discussed. I want to thank him for trying to pull everybody together on something that's really complex, has many perspectives. But as we state in our letter, our very best effort, and I testified, I believe, with the exact same words on 3115, our best effort to move forward on apprenticeship requirement, utilization requirement on public works is contained in the original bill, Senate Bill 782. I do want to underscore that this bill comes to you in its original form with overwhelming support from the Senate, unanimous. And it was supported, and I believe still is supported, by the Northwest Construction Alliance. That includes the operating engineers and the carpenters. And what we believe it does is it's just a first initial step to increase apprenticeship opportunities. Most importantly, it does it without unintended consequences that we believe could come with an entirely new public contracting requirement, and that one that we believe will eventually grow to impact and be applied to larger public works, more and more of them. Our principles and what drives us in fashioning what we did in 782 are these, and these are really important. We believe these are foundational issues. One, a statewide apprenticeship requirement must be flexible enough to actually implement on a full range of public works projects. This is not about a single project. It is about a statewide standard. Secondly, it must work for all types of contractors, and by that, we mean both union and open. And it has to work for all sizes of contracts, large and small. And finally, it needs to be flexible enough to work in all parts of the state, and this is a really key point for us, without disadvantaging smaller local contractors, which is possible to do depending on how you fashion an apprenticeship utilization requirement. So for all those reasons, what we can support is the flat 10% requirement that applies only to state projects, $5 million and larger, as it is in the bill. And I didn't want to confuse anybody. We signed up in support, but that is in support of the original bill. Given the complexity of the issues surrounding apprenticeship and its importance to our industry, we definitely support some sort of interim work group task force. That could be formal or informal. It works both ways. We've seen it work that way. Our belief is that it should be industry and stakeholder driven and charged with these three fundamental tasks. Determining the feasibility impediments that an apprenticeship utilization requirement will produce, evaluate the existing two successful models. This is key to us. It took a couple of years. ODOT now has a very successful program. It is a program, not a standard statewide policy, which is what being anticipated today, that works for highway work. It doesn't translate itself into building side of the construction industry. And to really look at the Washington State model. It has been in evolution for close to a decade. And I spend a fair amount of time trying to figure out what it is and what it isn't. So we think a group needs to look at that. Seriously, it's the best experience we have.
Okay, John, and, can you wrap up?
Sure. Okay. I guess I'll wrap up this way. In addition to the Dash 4 amendments, in addition to changing the basic bill that had such support at the Senate level, it creates what we from the industry look at is a predetermined set of outcomes. And for that reason, we asked the Dash 5, and I don't know if they've been submitted or to the committee or not, be presented in hopes that it would look at the charges I just described it. And so with that, I'll end my testimony, turn it over to Tom Girding. He is a real-life contractor. We hope that that actually would have to implement this type of requirement on public works, and hopefully that will be a real benefit to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Tom, welcome.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Girding, and I'm serving as president of AGC Board of Directors, but I'm here today as a building contractor operating throughout the state of Oregon. Girding Companies, Girding Builders is my company. Nobody supports apprenticeship more than our industry, and that's why currently there are many apprenticeship programs in existence supported by labor and management associations and other interested parties. Why? It's simple. Our capacity to build our businesses and our industry is directly dependent on the availability of a highly skilled workforce. In this economic time and in the challenging conditions still facing the majority of our industry, we must be extraordinarily careful about adding an apprenticeship utilization requirement on public works projects. Again, why? Because, and I'll speak personally very much to this, we still have career-driven tradesmen and women who have spent their lifetimes in our industry, yet are still benched and waiting to get back to work. The question is, how do we create a supply to meet what is the actual demand? And as our industry truly recovers, that is why a gradual phase-in is so important. And speaking personally, I have crews that have been with me in excess of 20 years, and it's to leave one of them unemployed only to hire an inexperienced individual to meet a requirement does not make sense to me morally or financially. It seems to me the critical issue here is not to overstep what the industry really needs. The result of doing so will have unintended impacts and consequences. In particular, we think about the small contractors as well as contractors operating in smaller markets around the state. And I, again, think of an example. If we had a public works project over in La Grande, I can think of several contractors in that area that would want to bid on it. And certainly would bid on it. Currently, there's not an abundance of apprenticeship opportunities over in that part of the state, and as a result, the requirement of a hard requirement on apprenticeship utilization would most certainly give an advantage to contractors operating in the metro area who have access to those apprenticeships and both in a workforce. So an example like that is a cautionary. So in closing, make no mistake, as you all certainly know, this is a very complex matter. I live it every day. It's what I do. In my view, what's needed now and what AGC supports is some sort of an interim work group that brings to the table those vested with the most knowledge and largest stake to get a realistic handle on what an apprenticeship utilization requirement should look like in the state of Oregon that serves the industry, both management and labor, as well as our public agencies. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Girding. Any questions? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Girding. I think we're all in this committee. We've expressed our support of apprenticeship programs. What do you think would be the expense to a contractor? Would the liability insurance go up if more apprentices you have? Has that been looked at or considered?
You know, I guess what I would say built into a good apprenticeship is safety as well. And so once again, it being done correctly, I don't think, my personal opinion is I don't think that would be, if it was done correctly. correctly. And again, it goes back to the basis of why we need to phase in and go slowly. Because
I'm trying to get more jobs for trial attorneys, but I don't. My objective. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I'm going to call up Dave Cutts.
Chair, are we?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Is that all? We're going to have any more time to?
Yeah, I was going to call up the rest. Did you have a question of that?
Please.
Okay.
I just want to double back on the CRC reference and the apprenticeship that was in that bill and so forth. And it would be helpful, I think, to understand more about that.
Okay.
That I think, from my understanding, and I wasn't a part of that, that what was put into the bill is a bit of a special circumstance that from my understanding, doesn't apply to the rest of public works projects in the state. Maybe John or Mr. Gerding, could you refer to that?
Chair Dimbrough, Representative Johnson, I spent a couple of weeks negotiating on the industry's behalf the entire section, the public contracting requirements section that includes the apprenticeship that Chair Dimbrough referenced in the introductory remarks. The rationale for that, as I was told repeatedly, was this is a once-in-a-lifetime mega project. For that reason, you have opportunities that are different, and the type of requirements like the apprenticeship makes sense. So when we negotiated out that language, we accepted that basic premise, and then we worked really hard to try to figure out how do you implement that in a way that you balance all the interest and the contractors can make it work. I guess I would say for the record once in a lifetime mega project is simply not the same thing as a statewide apprenticeship standard. The original bill, and I think the amendments, contemplate only statewide projects currently, but in the work group that is attached to Dash 4 amendments, it contemplates expanding it beyond those projects. So I see whatever gets put in place, the legislature chooses to put in place, will eventually become a statewide standard that applies broadly. So one big mega project versus a statewide standard that applies across the universe, those are just not comparable in my view.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
For John and then for others that come up and testify, I'd like to hear the reasoning, as far as you know, why this bill had such strong support on the Senate side, but it came over here and got controversial. Any thoughts on that?
Chair
Is that Dimbrough. Too lengthy?
Chair Dimbrough, Vice Chair Huffman, I've been working on the apprenticeship issue for 4 years now. And I've said, I think individually, including to the chair and other members of this committee, I've never cracked the code. This is a really complex issue. We don't pretend that our bill is the be-all, end-all. It's a good first step. I think that's why it had such enormous support on the Senate side, was it's an initial, cautious, prudent first step that allows us to some degree, model what has happened in the state of Washington. They started almost 10 years ago with 10% on state projects only, large projects. So I think we took a model, we took the best we could from ODOT and tried to fashion something based upon experience, and that seemed to win the day on the Senate side. But I will tell you, I think of the apprenticeship as a sort of set of apprenticeship wars. All of the parties who are going to testify today were in the hall earlier, and we're all talking about how complex, how difficult, and how many different perspectives there are, and how important it is to the industry, labor, and management. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's the perspective I have on it.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. And we may get more insight from subsequent panels. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Okay, I'm going to call up Dave Cutts, John Mollis, and Dennis Copeland, please.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I would like to reiterate, as John and others are coming up, that question
yes.
was for
yes.
future panels, too.
I don't think your current questions can bind future panels.
I was hoping.
We're the same session. Welcome, gentlemen. Start, Dave.
Good morning. Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, my name is David Cutts, and thanks for allowing me the opportunity again to speak with you. I've spoke with you in the past concerning the other bill you referenced earlier.
Right.
I just wanted to reiterate that our company, Paragon Tile and Stone, is very involved in apprenticeship and totally supports it. I also represent ABC, Associated Builders and Contractors, as a board chair for the Public Affairs committee. And I just would like to verbalize my concern in the sense of, because I believe in apprenticeship and I know that there's been a lot of effort and work put towards this, I'm not quite sure what the reasoning for implementing something and then trying to figure out how to make it work. I support let's make it work, let's figure out how to make it work, and then implement it. I think we're on the right track, we're moving down the right path, but I'd sure hate to put the cart before the horse. ABC represents, or we represent, we're in support of this work group, and we'd like to solve the problem and not create one.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Good morning, Representative Chair Dembro, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Dennis Copeland. I work at UA 290, Plumbers and Steam Fitters. We have a long, well-established apprenticeship program. We have over 360 active apprentices now and getting ready to bring on another 300 for work that we have. Apprenticeship is a valuable tool. We have members in the working community now that are of average age of 50 years or older. It is critical that we bring people in and start getting them trained to replace these people that will be going out in just a few years. While we appreciate and value the work that you're doing on this amendment or this bill and the amendments that have been proposed, we feel that there are serious issues. It is a thought, if you will. We want apprenticeship. But we need to have more substance, more meat to what it exactly is it going to represent? What is it going to look like when it comes out there and actually becomes a law? One of those things about being a law is enforcement. Many people have mentioned the Washington State program that has a similar program that we're trying to aspire to. Unfortunately, routinely, even though they have a ratio now that they're requiring 15%, contractors, after the work has been turned in, are turning in where they have worked 6% or less apprentices on the job, which goes to the crux of the problem, enforcement. How do you enforce this? Go to Boley. Radovakian already is working 10 people short. He's already been handed the sick leave program from City of Portland, which is going to need more enforcement people. This is going to be a bill that is almost impossible to regulate if you don't have the teeth to it, which is the enforcement. We need to have something brought up in the bill of how we're going to address that issue. Other issue is subsidy. We would think that that money would be better used in going to the enforcement of the policy, spent in that area, rather than being given to contractors to subsidize people who are already receiving the prevailing wage for that work. So with those two things in mind, I would seriously say that we'd have reservations about the proposed amendments and bills without something being addressed to the enforcement of the issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is John Molis. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Oregon State Building Trades Council. Apprenticeship is like motherhood and apple pie. It sounds really good. Everybody's in favor of it. I very much appreciate Chair Dembro's dedication to the apprenticeship and everybody that believes in it. But once you get into it, it becomes very complex and very complicated very quick. The local that I belong to, Bricklayers and Allied Craftworkers Local 1 of Oregon, turned 120 last year. The handout that I just provided to you is from our original minute book. It's a copy of a letter that was written by the then recording secretary to a young man about how to make application to be an apprentice bricklayer. So we've been doing this for 125 years, literally, in this state, without any state mandates, without any subsidies, without anybody telling us that we need to do this, because we know we need to do it. Apprenticeship is our system of higher ed. It's our lifeblood. It's what makes our organizations run. So we believe in this. We've got some, and I'm speaking now to the bill with the -4 amendments, which are a huge improvement. We still have some concerns. Dennis mentioned a couple of them. The subsidy that's been taken out. We appreciate that. We don't believe that contractors should be paid for having apprentices on the payroll. A funding source for enforcement would be very important to us. We've seen contracting agencies in the past enforce it for our contractors, and then when other folks come along and say, well, we don't have a program, they say, well, we'll give you a waiver, and that leaves a bad taste in our mouth. The other issue, and Vice Chair Huffman isn't here for me to answer his question, but one of the problems that we've had with this was just the lack of our council's inclusion into this process. The first time that we were invited to into a group to discuss this was about 2 weeks ago on the 100th day of this legislative assembly, and that seems pretty late in the game to me to provide input into a topic that's this complicated. We had a meeting yesterday. A lot of my business managers and training coordinators were there, and they feel that they haven't had adequate time to provide input into this bill. So we would like to offer some amendments that we would hope that you would consider in the future and be part of any effort or work group in the future that would consider to, consider this legislation on whatever time frame you folks decide.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
Any questions? Yes, Rep. Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate this copy, but people can't see here. The original down here, it was a CC to Mitch Greenlick.
I didn't answer that one either.
Thank you. Any further questions, colleagues?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the panel, I didn't really figure or get your response. We have a bill that passed the Senate, and now we have some amendments to that bill. And I'm not sure what I heard Mr. Copeland say that he liked the original bill out of the Senate, I think.
No, sir. It still had reservations as far as there wasn't substance to the bill. The bill was an idea, if you will, rather than giving the substance of how we were going to implement it, how we're going to enforce it, how we're going to...
You're speaking about the amendments.
Right,
the problems.
Everything.
Yeah.
All right, Mr. Chair.
But it would be fair to say, just to follow up, that you were not in support of the original bill.
No, sir. Not in its present form.
All right, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
The bill's for a task force, is that correct?
The bill is, most of it is for a task force, but it also sets the standard beginning in July with the idea that that would be fleshed out in the February session based on the input from the work group.
Again, my question to the panel, are you for a task force to look at all these aspects? We may disagree about how the task force is set up and putting standards that the task force is supposed to justify, I guess, or not justify. That I'm not sure about that as a task force mission, but so you're for a task force to look into the issue. Is that correct? And we're not setting standards right today or with a legislation that's going to say you must have 10% or 15% or 12%. And I would also enforcement, we have ourselves in a pickle that the governor's asked us to come up with how many $38 million to reduce our cost of prison. So, I sort of disagree with you, and I think that I'd rather have a system that rewards compliance than punishes because of all the manpower, woman power that takes to enforce. So I don't understand, because the bottom line is that if you're paying for that, the price is going to go up for the taxpayers, and it's going to some way maybe affect your members too as far as costs. So mm-hmm. I'm really confused about what we're doing here, Mr. Chair. So
great. That is an excellent question, Rep. Wilson, but we don't have time to get into that now. But yes, Rep.
Greenland. I want to avoid a little confusion. Doesn't the amendment in Section 2, in Part 2 of Section 1, set the policy? And the task force designs.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, and the task force is designed to answer those questions that the gentlemen have raised about compliance, about enforcement, about subsidy versus holdback, the incentives, disincentives to compliance. And
the amendment does set the policy.
It sets the standard.
Policy for a task force.
Correct. Yes, Rick Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Molas and panel, just a question about process again. Regarding the original bill, the bill was on the Senate side. Business Transportation, a good bipartisan committee over there, and came out unanimously, I believe, came to the floor of the Senate again, 29-0, with one absence. And I'm just, what was your role during that process on the Senate side? Was it in a, were you involved? Just tell me about your role prior to today, I guess, with this piece of legislation.
Yes, Chair Denbrough, Representative Johnson. In that Senate committee that you referenced, I testified as neutral. I shared my concerns about the subsidy. I said that was very troubling to me, and that if it moved out of the Senate, that I would be working for amendments over here in the House. I made that clear to the proponents of the bill as well. So the subsidy and just the lack of process and the late time frame are the things that concern me. And like I say, I stayed neutral over there, but I made it clear to everybody that I would be offering amendments over here. To satisfy the yeah. Council's
thank
request.
You. Yes, thank you, Mr. Mullis. And just for the members of the audience who may not be familiar with our process, this does happen once in a while, or maybe more than once in a while, that a bill does really well in one chamber and then problems surface and it doesn't do so well on the other. It needs to be changed. I have seen that happen before. So thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to call up Russ Garnett and Brian Creek, please.
I also want to point out the importance of apprenticeship programs because I clearly am not a licensed timekeeper. All right, this is my apprenticeship here.
Don't expect a bonus. Okay, Russ.
Good morning, Representative Denbrough and committee members. My name is Russ Garnett. I'm the business manager of Roofers and Waterproofers, Local 49. We cover the entire state of Oregon and Southwest Washington. I'm a graduate from our own apprenticeship program 25 years ago. We've been doing this for 30-odd years. I've been an involved member of apprenticeship ever since then. It's been a great thing for me and for a lot of other people. We've been doing this for this reason, not for any sort of subsidy or anything. It's because it's our future. The only way we're going to survive is to have training, have a skilled workforce, have a safe workforce. These are the things, like I say, we've been doing forever. We support apprenticeship utilization wholeheartedly. At the same time, I share some concerns with some of the other members that we might be putting a cart before the horse. And I do agree. I would like to offer our support in building this cart, so to speak, and putting this on a level footing. The enforcement issues are kind of troubling. You know, the idea that we reward people for compliance in this day is probably not a safe assumption. If we look at Washington and we see what's happened with their apprenticeship and what the compliance is there, it kind of tells us that, well, compliance will be probably forced and that's it. For our trade, we've been doing, like I said, this training for 30-odd years. The open shop non-union competition has done zero in state-approved training apprenticeship in the last 15 years, ever since I've been on our committee. And that says a lot for what we do. The idea that we need a subsidy or something to utilize our future workforce is troubling. If there is a subsidy, it needs to go, like we say, towards enforcement and these sorts of things. But I would suggest that, you know, we do form some work groups and we work on this issue and put something together that fits for everybody, possibly in the next legislature. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Russ. Brian, welcome.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg. Today I'm here representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association and also the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. here to talk about 782. We feel that the -4 amendments are a significant improvement over the bill. I'm not sure if it's quite there yet. As you've heard from, and I agree with many of the things that were said by the previous panel and Russ here, and I won't go over a lot of that ground again. It is a complex matter, and it needs a broad task force look at trying to do this, because each of the crafts are a little bit different. Each of the situations out on the jobs are a little different in how you staff them and crew them, and each public contract can be very different and deal with the issues of mixes that are on the job site. We really think that this needs to be a look at similar to what was done with the public contracting task force over the last 2 years, where there's a lot of people in the room brought in. That took a while, two-year process, many meetings, a lot of Tylenol, shall we say, was involved on that. Yeah. But we came out with on that is we didn't go in with a lot of preconceived notions. We just knew that there were some issues and problems that all sides were seeing. There's more than one side to that or two. That process looked at a lot of what we thought maybe were the simple answer, found maybe that really wasn't it, but we found a bunch of things where we were able to work together and move the ball forward, and that wasn't used in developing the first version of this bill, and that was a troubling aspect. I did testify neutral but with concerns on the other side. It also, in the speed that it came up, my construction folks are very busy at the moment, or trying to be busy and getting work. So getting information back, and with such a diverse group of them, was very hard in a short amount of time when this wasn't brought up really in advance. So there are a couple of things that have to happen with this. Also, the funding for enforcement. We've got to find a methodology for that in a way, because we've seen some programs that have been experimented with in some of the different jurisdictions in Oregon. The South Waterfront Project is one that has quite a few of the things that are talked about in the -4. The industry, though, was very involved in that process, and a very different structure used there for making sure that there was compliance. And there were problems there. There were fines assessed against those who tried to game the system a little bit on it. We've had that situation, though, the gaming of the system in other places. This is very troubling for a contractor who wants to do the right thing, puts their bid together in the correct method, is going to do the right thing, and then they're bidding against somebody who knows that they're going to try and game the system. You're not playing on with a fair, even field on that. So the issue of the enforcement for our contractors, I think, is one of the cruxes of the matter here for us on that, and making sure that we do that. Apprenticeship is a serious commitment. We want to make sure that the people we put into the system get through it, and that we have an obligation to them. It's also a huge investment. The Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association is not the largest trade association in the state. We recognize that and all. But each year, we put $1.5 million into training our apprentices and keeping our journeymen up to standards. Tens of millions of dollars have been invested by the trades in their training centers and the programs they have going on right now. And I think a lot of those folks run some very good programs, in fact, model programs in this nation, and need to be at that table. There's a great amount of talent there to be picked out and used to come up with the right solutions for this. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Colleagues, any quick questions of these two? Yes, Rip Johnson.
Mr. Krieg, thanks for being here. You mentioned process again, and referring back to the CMGC task force, which you're right was a long slog to get through some pretty tricky waters that had taken, I think, the industry a long time to come to some sort of consensus, I guess, on what the best pathway forward. And you know, we had the bill this session that accomplished that. What I hear you saying is you're not enthralled with what you find here in the -4s in terms of some of the policy may be preordained already, and it isn't necessarily a process where we would go in with our eyes open, with everybody could be on a level playing field and have a discussion about what would be best to move the industry forward and so forth. So I appreciate what you're talking about, because I do think it's one of these areas where, if in fact the task force is going to be successful in trying to accomplish something that's good for all of Oregon, we need to go in without a lot of preconceived ideas about what works and what doesn't. Let's talk together. Let's think about what the best pathway forward could be. So appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Rep. Johnson, I would say that I'm not sure the dashboards include any policy other than setting that 10% standard. What it does is it raises topics of concern that will need to be addressed by the work group without anticipating, you know, what the particular incentives will be, what the particular compliance mechanisms will be, or any of that. It's just the issues that are going to need to be addressed. So I'm not sure there's any preordained policy, I would say. Okay, thank you, colleagues. Witnesses, sorry.
Good morning.
Our final panel is Rick Metzger and Jim Francesconi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Metzger, and I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Construction Alliance, which consists of the International Union of Operating Engineers and the Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. I want to make a couple of points and make sure the committee understands what has brought us here today. Number one, I want to commend Chair Denborough for bringing everyone together, listening to their concerns, and putting together what you have as the Dash 4 Amendment. I was in that meeting. I heard the concern of our fellow trade workers, that they were concerned about the $20 subsidy. They were concerned about craft-specific. They were concerned about deferring other things to work group. You did all of that in your amendment. But as the result is, as you hear, they still do not want to support the bill because it is confusing and complicated. Keep in mind that Washington does have a 15% standard that started at 10. It isn't craft specific. It doesn't have penalties. And despite what you heard previously, they have come very, very close to meeting those type of standards. And all of our trade groups and contractors work across the Columbia River and do it very well. In the city of Portland, there's a 20% standard. And all of us in this room have been doing that for years and doing it well. It hasn't been too complicated. We are the only state on the West Coast that doesn't have a state standard for apprenticeship. It's 20% in the state of California, 15% in the state of Washington. Given the comments today, I would stand in support of the original Bill 782 because of what you heard today, that we can't seem to move the ball. That's why we had the strong vote out of the Senate, and all those arguments were heard, but they felt, as I believe, you know, this body should feel, is that unless we put that stake in the ground, this conversation will continue to be circular, as it has been for the last 4 years. By putting that stake in the ground, people are forced to come together and work to improve, to change, to alter, but to make that commitment. You've done a great job in trying to bring that together. We believe that moving forward is important to the state and our future workforce. And if you consider the fact that you'll be voting soon, I believe, on a $2.2 million taxpayer fund through the Oregon Department of Transportation for pre-apprenticeship training to provide lodging so people can go over to La Grande and provide child care so they can become apprentices and go across the state to do this. But what purpose is it if there's no job then at the end of the day to be the apprentice to finally become a journeyman? This is not as complicated as it is. I'd also like to speak just briefly, Mr. Chair, about process. I remember process. I was involved in it 4.5 years ago, and we are here today hearing how difficult this is, and if we just kept talking, somehow we would do something. And we are here today, and you'll be here next year, and unless the legislature decides we want to make a commitment and put you together to see how this might be effectual. This process, you had a bill in here that had these same issues for a number of months, and people could participate or not participate as they wish. We had a bill in the Senate for 2 months, which people could participate or not participate as they wish. I salute our partners on this was AGC. We don't see eye to eye on a lot of things, and we pushed and dragged them, and they pushed and dragged us because we both had a commitment that let's set a state standard, let's get moving, let's do what other people have found to to be not only not complicated but significant to their state. I would ask you to support 782. I would support Chair Dembrough's amendment, but in the light of others, I would want to then suggest that we revert to where we had bipartisan support, which is what got us forward, got us moving forward, and having a work group as part of that, I think, is important, and it is critical. But the commitment to having a product from the work group isn't going to exist unless there's a goal that people know they have to meet, and we believe that's important. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, I represent the same folks that Rick Metzger, the carpenters and operating engineers. My main,
Jim, you're, pardon? My good neighbor, your name, please.
Jim Franciscini, sorry. This has been a kind of difficult, probably the most vexing issue I've ever worked on in public policy over the last 20 years, and we need your help. And Chair Dembrough, we really appreciate your leadership. Everybody in this room has expressed and deeply believes in the value of apprenticeship. The reason people support apprenticeship is it's one of the few ways that you can have Oregonians working on the capital projects you fund. Apprenticeship requirements actually make that happen. What I'd like to briefly shed, I kind of played Rick's role 2 years ago trying to work this through, so I want to answer Representative Huffman and Representative Johnson some just on the background here. We work pretty hard. The carpenters, operators are not part of the building trades, but we have the same values and principles in terms of behalf of working people, so we work very hard to try to work on an agreement with them 2 years ago to present something unified to you that implemented the apprenticeship. There's a genuine, and you heard it here today, the union apprenticeship put a lot of money and training and programs into these pre-apprenticeship programs. The non-union folks don't. The carpenters and operators feel like their union apprenticeships as the building trades are so good that we're going to will compete with non-union programs, and that's not the issue. The issue is this the right thing for the state? We could not overcome that 2 years ago, and it was frustrating to me because instead of looking at what's the best policy, people were forced to just get agreements over genuine issues on labor side that we couldn't agree to. So, you know, I respected both sides, but it died. This time, with the leadership of Doug Tweedy and Rick Metzger, and I have not been involved in the day-to-day of this, we took an approach to work with the contractors to see if we could come up with a common effort to crack something that we couldn't crack before. And that's what happened on the Senate side. It would be my opinion that focusing on enforcement right now is not what we need to do as we build a relationship to kind of move both forward, okay? So we appreciate your leadership, and we need your help to do this, and we believe that over time people will get really comfortable with this, and we can make it happen. And again, in conclusion, the issue isn't what we think over here. We need some help from you deciding what's best for the workers of the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both of you. Any questions of these gentlemen? Yes, Rip Greenlick.
Do you support the Dash 4 amendments? I wasn't sure I...
I'm going to let Rick answer that.
We have pledged to Rep. Dembrough that the most important thing is to put that stake in the ground and move forward, and we would be supportive of that. We don't want to put the chair of the committee in a situation in which we're not going to move forward on the floor because so many people want to work against it. That's why I said, given the scenario that we heard here today, I would prefer a bill that we know that we can move bipartisan, which is 782. But again, because we believe, as Jim Francisconi just said, that the overall policy of establishing that we are committed as a state to apprenticeship, we're willing to move. And getting others to move has been difficult. But we're willing to support what this committee would do to move that stake forward.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, both
of you.
So with that, colleagues, I'm going to close this public hearing on Senate Bill 782. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 782, and we're going to carry this bill forward till Friday. Just received some Dash 5 amendments. Haven't had a chance to look at them, and sorry to hold you all in suspense for a couple of days, but we actually don't have the fiscal on this anyway, so we couldn't move the bill today anyway. We'll come back to it on Friday. Okay, so with that, we're carrying over Senate Bill 782. I'll close the work session on 782. Those of you who came to testify today, thank you very much for coming and helping us. I'm going to open now our informational hearing on remediation. Maybe I should call it New Trends in Remediation in the State of Oregon in the year 2013. And we have several panels to share their expertise with us. The first is Elizabeth Cox-Brand, please, Karen Sanders, and Kurt Simons.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Brand, Director of Communications and Research for CCWD. As I was preparing to come over here in place of Commissioner Preuss, she said, well, one of the things you want to look at is that recent report that talked about how many students need developmental education. And I said, which one? I can't open my email without seeing a new report about how many students are in need of developmental education. Complete College America, which Chair Dembro and Rep. Johnson are familiar with, shows that over 50% of students who are pursuing an associate's degree need some sort of developmental education. 20% of students seeking a baccalaureate degree need some sort of developmental education. So clearly, community colleges are quite aware of this, and we are doing things in Oregon to help address this issue. One way that we are helping...
What does developmental education mean?
I'm sorry?
What does developmental education mean?
Developmental education is, Rep. Dembro, Rep. Greenlick, developmental education is what we refer to instead of remediation.
And that means?
Getting them up to starting level.
Is that what we're talking about?
Yes.
Another term is pre-college. So.
That was one of the things.
High school graduation.
Yeah.
In Lawrence High School.
Chair Dembro, that was actually one of the things that we were talking about when I was meeting with the panel prior to this, was how it can be so confusing because there are many terms that are used to mean basically the same thing. So we're hoping that we won't muddy the waters any further, but we'll help clarify if we can. As I was saying, we are doing many different things in Oregon to address this need. I'm not going to take too much of the time because it's more important that my panelists have a chance to actually address this issue. But there are things such as there are 10 community colleges in Oregon that are involved in Achieving the Dream, which is a nationwide movement that has a specific focus on developmental education and underrepresented students, but helping get those students through so that they can actually achieve whatever it is that they had come to the community college to achieve. On May 10th, we actually had an event. CCWD convened over 100 faculty members from developmental education throughout the state of Oregon, from faculty from writing, math, and reading. And we brought in two facilitators from the California Acceleration Project to talk about the need for reform in developmental education. What can we do to help make this different? The momentum from that is exciting. People are ready for making some change. We're planning to put together a statewide task force to actually take a look at this, have that task force primarily made up of faculty and representatives from all of the different stakeholders from the community colleges. And Complete College America actually had indicated that they're willing to help fund some of that work so we can bring folks together. So I'm very excited about that, and maybe tapping some of these folks who are coming up to talk to help me with that effort. So without further ado, I will turn it over to my colleagues from the community colleges, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Representative Dembrough and committee members, good morning. My name is Karen Sanders, and I'm a dean at Portland Community College, and I oversee the pre-college programs at the Rock Creek campus. So I'm going to talk today about two programs. One of them is a statewide program, and one of them is one that we're doing specifically at PCC that work to take students who are not yet at college level in reading, writing, and math, get their skills up to speed, and then move them into college-level programs. So the first program I'm going to be talking about, great acronym, it's called OPABS, and OPABS stands for Oregon Pathways for Adult Basic Skills. And adult basic skills is another term like pre-college or remediation. It's adult students who don't have a high school diploma or aren't up to speed on their reading, writing, and math skills. So the OPABS framework is something that was developed statewide by a group of faculty and administrators from 9 of the community colleges to basically reform the way adult basic skills and GED prep programs were done. So for a long time, it was, you know, finish your GED, work in a workbook, and you're finished. And there's been a real paradigm shift nationally and in Oregon to move from what I would say is high school equivalency to college readiness. And there is definitely a gap between, not for everybody, but for many people, between completing high school and being ready for college. So OPABS is a system that has two pieces that run through the whole thing. So if you look at the diagram there, employment runs through the whole program, a focus on employment. And then in the bottom, the college advising support services, in addition to the academic instruction, it's very important that we support the students with things like advising and tutoring, counseling, those kinds of things. So the actual program...
Excuse me, Karen, can I just butt in? What do you mean by referral to one step there on the bottom?
So one of the key components for OPABS is a partnership between the WorkSource centers and the community colleges. And the idea is that we work together to get folks who are unemployed into an education program and back and forth. So that's a really key component.
Okay.
Okay, so the instructional pieces, as you can see up there, we work with students who have as low as a 6th to 8th grade reading, writing, or math level. So this program takes them at that level, provides them with the academic instruction, moves them through to a GED certificate if they don't have a high school diploma already, and then transitions them into either training, professional technical programs, or transfer, lower division transfer degree programs. In addition to that, there's also a simultaneous component of career and college readiness. So in addition to the skills component, they also have instruction in soft skills and things that will help them both in college and in employment. So today, all or some of these courses are being offered at 10 of the 17 community colleges. Depending on the size, urban, rural, there's different configurations. But it's proven really successful in taking students with low academic skills and giving them a goal so that they say, okay, you know, we talk about career exploration, what would you like to do, and then move them towards that goal, getting a GED along the way. Okay, so the second program that I'd like to briefly talk about is something that we're doing at PCC, and it's connected to career pathways. Once again, ABS stands for Adult Basic Skills, and it's ESOL, which is English as a Second Language students, or Adult Basic Education students. So these pathways are for students who do not have a high school diploma, are reading and writing below the 12th grade level. The concept is to move them into college-level programs. And if you look at the top boxes, this component of the pathway is consistent no matter which career area you're looking at. So for every career area, the students have an academic support class and an internship, and then also advising, tutoring, those kinds of things. The bottom three components are three different programs. So for example, CAS 121 is computer application systems, beginning keyboarding. The students would take those five classes in addition to having the academic support. So the computer applications instructor and the basic reading and writing instructor work together to move them through, and at the end of the program they have 14 college credits and a career pathway certificate. And the reason this is different is up until this point, the traditional method has been you do your prerequisites, you know, you have to do your reading, writing, and math, and it's only when you finish that that you can move into college programs. This model, they do it simultaneously. So they contextualize the reading, writing, and math skills with the career area that they're interested in. So these three different programs, one is in computer applications, one is in accounting clerk, and one is in retail management. So the students at the conclusion have increased their basic skills, and they've also received some college credits and are on their way towards an associate's degree. Okay, let's see what else.
So, Karen, if I can butt in. So, presumably, they have adequate reading and math skills to be able to handle the textbooks and the material in those other classes. Is that correct?
So the model is their reading, writing, and math skills are lower than what was previously thought to be required to be successful in those classes. And it's worked, I think, because when the students, for example, in the retail management know that they have to improve their reading, writing skills because it's something they're going to be doing on the job, there seems to be more motivation. And then curriculum-wise, the two instructors work together so that the basic skills aren't isolated. They're contextualized in the information. So there were a lot of people that were skeptical and said, you know, you really need to have solid skills before you start. And what this experiment has shown is that we can actually take people with lower skills and more quickly and sooner move them towards credentials and degrees.
Rather than keeping them stuck in
correct
the pre part. Yes. Rip Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may have already mentioned this. I'm sorry if you did, but I'm assuming that the students that you're referring to are not high school graduates, or are some of them high school graduates, or what's
it's
the,
both.
It's both.
Right. So some of the students do have undergraduate.
And then a follow-up with the increased rigor in the Oregon diploma. Are you seeing fewer students coming to you with 6th through 8th grade skill sets or whatever, or not? Or do you anticipate having fewer of these students in this category here that you're referring to?
So a lot of these students are adults who dropped out of school 15
sure
years ago and are now trying to come back.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'll just go back to this slide because I don't have additional information. I'm Kurt Simons. I'm the Dean of Instruction at the Cascade campus at Portland Community College. I started out as a teacher of developmental reading and writing in college English and worked in writing across the curriculum. What Karen has been talking about primarily are those students without the high school degree or GED, although some do have that. But when we talk about developmental education, we're also talking about students who do have those high school degrees or GEDs and come to us still without the kind of reading, writing, and math skills that are required to be successful in college level work. Some of them have been out of school for a long time, and the math may have disappeared from their from their memory. Others maybe were not terribly successful in school to begin with, but were able to graduate from high school and are coming back after a gap and still need to improve those basic skills in reading and writing and math. At PCC, we're at the beginning of a process of looking at how we deliver instruction in reading, writing, and math at the pre-college level. And part of this is part of the overall completion agenda that we're trying to come to terms with in terms of how we get students through our prerequisites, how we get them through our basic skills and entry-level courses, and then on to successful completion of career technical and transfer programs. One of the things that we've done is we've looked at our orientation advising process. We've looked at our tutoring resources. Within our math area, we're working on some curricular innovations and piloting activities in self-paced and contextualized math. And then we've recently launched a task force to look at how we deliver pre-college instruction in developmental reading and writing and making sure that our programs are aligned with our college-level expectations in our entry-level college reading and writing classes. So, as I said, we're at the beginning of that process. I want to stop and make sure my colleagues from other colleges have an opportunity to tell you more about what they've done. I think they have more detail to offer in terms of some of the innovations that they've undertaken at those colleges.
Questions, colleagues?
I do have one. Well, so in looking at the new approaches to remediation, which, you know, I think the program that you just shared with us is an example of that, we're moving away from a kind of cookie-cutter approach to remediation, right, where, you know, you take X number of hours, X number of weeks, X number of terms, and then hopefully you're ready for college. But you're trying to do something that's more flexible. Would that be fair to say?
Representative Dembro. That is fair to say. I think that some of the things that Karen mentioned and that some of my colleagues will talk about are the contextualization of those basic skills within courses, the acceleration or intensification through boot camps or other short-term activities, moving people into college level with support courses and tutoring as opposed to holding them back from those things that help motivate them and keep them progressing. Those are all models that are being tried around the country, and we're looking in Oregon and at PCC at some of those best practices and looking at that research and trying to figure out what we can adopt here at home.
Great, thank you. Okay, colleagues, I should tell you that once the session ends, and I'll be teaching this summer, Kurt will be my boss. And so if you thought my question of him was a real softball, it was. Okay, thank you, all three.
Chair, I do have one question.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
I'm curious, you know, how do you deal with any stigma that students going through these programs might feel being, you know?
I think stigma is a real issue. The sense that they're being segregated into non-college work or not real college work. And I think that the contextualization and the support in a higher, you know, in credit classes or in credit programs is a way that helps both overcome some of that stigma and really helps really motivate students to, they can see the goal and they're closer to being achieving their goal by starting at a different level and being in classes with students who are pursuing the same goals that they are. So I think that stigma, that segregation has really been a significant issue that we're trying to overcome.
Also, the courses are more interesting, aren't they? I mean, as opposed to just drill work or whatever to work on basic skills.
Right. That's where the contextualization becomes very important.
Okay, thank you, panel. All right, I'm going to call up three people from community colleges, Susan Murray, Jennifer Newby, and Shireen Wembley-Gouveia. Sorry if I damaged your name, Shireen.
You did a perfect job.
And then, colleagues, we'll be having a panel from the universities.
How accepted.
Yes, thank you.
Good morning, Representative Dembro and members of the committee. We really appreciate the opportunity to come and speak with you today about very important work. And I think, as you've certainly ascertained from my colleagues, the group of people that we deal with is very diverse.
We need you to identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Susan Murray from Chemeketa Community College. The group of people we deal with in our courses, in our programs, is extremely diverse. It ranges from high school dropouts to re-entry workers that are coming back that maybe didn't complete high school, may have left to work in the mills or work in industry or work in construction, housewives, teen parents. It's a very diverse group. And so what we find is multiple approaches are really crucial. As students first enter our programs, one of the first barriers they face is a placement test. And that placement test to date has been quite a sort. It's sorted students, maybe inappropriately, into very low levels of coursework. And that coursework then becomes an impediment to their entering programs and completing degrees. What we find is many students simply aren't ready for the placement test, at which point they may need some remediation. Other students just need sort of a brush up in the placement test and could actually test much higher. We also find that sometimes these tests are culturally biased or rarely antiquated in many of their questions that they've asked. They don't really serve our students well as an appropriate assessment of their skills. And so what's happened in the past is we would go placement test place and into a full year oftentimes of remediation where students are isolated and there is stigma attached. New thinking. Thank goodness. And I started as an instructor in these areas also. So we've known for a long time that that sort of antiquated traditional process did not work with our students. And the new thinking is really much better. Previously, with that sequential approach, we asked students to take their time and resources, oftentimes financial aid, to do remediation perhaps for a year, year and a half, without even entering a college program, and the content was not relevant to their interest areas. We know from national data that completion rates with a student that starts in remediation goes that long is not very high. So our new thinking is we're looking at the placement test, we're looking at different sorts, we're looking at moving students much more quickly through a system, contextualizing. You'll hear from my colleagues, and I know from a recent statewide meeting of all the community college instructional administrators, we are all doing significant work. So with that said, there are a number of ways that Chemeketa in particular is changing this. One way is we're starting with our placement test. We're reevaluating it. We're looking at different tests. In addition, we're preparing a skills brush up that actually we've already piloted. It seems to be making a big difference. So students can be prepared to take the test and ready for the types of questions they have to answer. We also offer individualized assessment and advising when students do take these tests so they can immediately know how important the test is, because frequently students don't fully understand that. If a student scores very low on those tests, we're able to provide alternate tests that give us a much more finely tuned ability to place students. And in addition, if a student really needs some help, we have what we call a fast-track lab where they can focus, say, on reading, writing, or math, maybe a couple of those areas, maybe for a few weeks rather than a full term, and be able to place higher. So that's one entry area we're finding makes a big difference. A second area is we're doing significant curriculum development that is compressing courses. So instead of taking, say, a writing 80, writing 90, writing 115 class, all of which really are not transfer level, might be relevant to our career technical education programs, but not to a transfer degree. Instead, we are compressing those, and students are able to take fewer of those courses before they enter a college program. Another thing that we're doing in curriculum development is creating a number of one-credit skill development courses that can be integrated and contextualized into programs. And again, this is one of those efforts to start students in a program and so that they are taking college credit classes with a credit supplement so that their reading and writing and math levels might be increased as they're engaged in studying the area that they entered college to study. We're also looking at closely integrating and contextualizing some of our faculty expertise with both programs in CTE and lower division transfer, where our faculty will come in and work with content area faculty to assist with contextualizing study skills. We've had some of this happen with great success in the past. As a connection with that, and recently we've had wonderful opportunities to asking content area faculty, actually working with our developmental ed faculty to really identify the needed skills to be successful in 100 and 200 level courses. This means that we know what the outcomes are clearly, and we're focusing our curriculum on those outcomes. That way, our curriculum is really relevant to those areas that our students hope to study. Our specialists are linking both ways, where we help content area faculty integrate study skills and basic skills. We are also learning how to integrate the general study skills into our curriculum. Another model that we've been trying for a number of years, but we haven't amortized it over the full college, is a sequence learning cohort, and that sounds kind of highfalutin, but what it really means is we're looking at identifying a group of students with very special needs. They go 3 terms with the same instructor and the cohort. We find that the integration of students knowing each other, knowing their faculty, over 3 terms, where we're integrating and starting with basic skills, a first-year experience class, supplemental instruction, a new way to offer the courses so that they're not always in 2 to 3 hour blocks 2 days a week. Our students don't do very well with that as they enter college. So as they move through 3 terms, they end up taking primarily college credits with additional support from their instructors. We build in tutoring, supplemental instruction, advising, transition into college programs in this model. In the last year in Woodburn, we've done this for 3 years with a special group of students in our early college program, many of which are ESOL, test in very low levels. We had 83% completion rate, and the majority, 45 of our 80 students were on the Phi Theta Kappa honor roll at Chemeketa and have transitioned the last 2 years into our college programs. It's been a pretty high-level success. We hope to increase the number of cohorts that we're able to offer this next few years.
And Susan, that's a much higher rate than is the norm for
much
remediation.
Higher. Right? We are very lucky, I think, with pre-college, if they're able to complete at all the sequence of remediation, least of all get 45 credits that are college credits. It's a significant difference. I think, as you all well know, this group takes special support services that without which students really will not succeed and have not succeeded in high numbers. But with those services and integrated and sort of accelerated services, what we're able to do is really make a radical difference in their completion rate. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Jennifer, welcome.
Can I touch this? Okay. Good morning, Chair Dembro and committee members. My name is Jennifer Newby. I'm an instructional dean at Central Oregon Community College. I've been asked to speak this morning about some of the initiatives that we have related to developmental education and transitioning students that are in pre-college to college-level coursework. So I have three initiatives that COCC is involved in. The first is something that we call our Transitional Studies Task Force, and the second is a math redesign, which I will talk about in just a second. We redesigned two of our developmental education math courses to accelerate the process of students moving through, and then we're also doing some contextualized math courses through our CASE grant. The first item is the Transitional Studies Task Force, and the purpose of that task force is to create a seamless path for students to transition from non-credit adult basic skills, which is ABE, GED, ESOL coursework, to all the way to college-level coursework. The composition of the task force is quite large. I am the lead of the task force as the instructional dean, and I have various faculty members and program administrators from math, from writing, from computer information systems, our human development, which are college readiness courses, faculty members, the director of testing, our director of retention, our IE person, which does all of our data for the college. It's a really large group. And our outcomes are focused on aligning those series of courses so that a student, if they started at the lowest end with ESOL or with ABE, GED, that they could successfully move through the series of courses. And what we're doing is we started with ABE, GED, and ESOL and created new learning outcomes. And what we're doing this year is we're aligning those course-level outcomes to the learning outcomes in the credit math and writing and CIS courses. And then what we're also doing as a task force is trying to develop a plan for the support services. Like Susan was mentioning, this population of students is so fragile that they need a lot of extra support in order to be successful. And what can we do to support them through that entire process? And I think that's it about the task force, unless you had questions. And you get an A if you realize that I didn't finish my sentence on my...
Yes, Rick, there you go.
Yeah, a number of you have used the term contextualized courses. What does that mean?
Yeah. Oh, do you want to talk?
Sure. Sorry, my name is Shireen Wimbley-Govea. Contextualization means we look at the college-level courses that students might be taking in the future, we hope they'll be taking in the future, and we infuse some instruction as we do the remediation. So students are learning topics, subjects, and asked to think at a college level before they take the courses. It makes them more exciting for them. I hope that helps.
And I think to add to that, some of the examples that I mentioned with our CASE grant, we took math and contextualized it to automotive and to manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And so that our adult basic skills math instructor is actually in the automotive bays with the students. And when they're working on electricity or the mathematics of electricity, she will actually take a student and say, oh, are you struggling with the math that is kind of at the foundation of this, and she'll pull them out, or she'll pull a group of students out and work with them real time on that math issue, and then put them back into the classroom. So we're taking content like math and writing and putting it in the context of a career focus. Culinary is another example. At COCC, we do a culinary writing class where all of the topics are around culinary items, but the foundation is in writing. Does that
Thank you. Okay. Yeah, we've actually been talking about that somewhat in the CTE world,
absolutely,
high school CTE, mm-hmm, you know, referring to it as applied learning.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yes.
And this next slide is just to give you a sense of what we do at COCC with placement. Susan mentioned placement, and we're also having these conversations about how students get placed. I put both the writing and the math placement guidelines for our college. As you will see, ABS is Adult Basic Skills. That's the non-credit programming, and we actually have that on our schedule so that when our advisors are working with our students, if their scores are too low, they're going to place them appropriately. One thing to note is that at COCC, we do something called, you know, ability to benefit in a sense. But in math, we don't require, there's no prerequisites on our math courses in COCC. So if you place into math 60, if you really wanted, you could take 65 and try it out. But in writing, it's the opposite. We have prereqs on our writing. So you can do the next slide. And then I just wanted to give you all a sense of the sequence of math courses, and this might help you understand how our courses work, but it, you start with Adult Basic Skills, Math 10, 20, 60, 65, and 95. Those are all developmental math courses. When we say developmental education, that is what we were talking about, below 100 level, below college level math. We have some little arrows going in and out because we've done some specific math courses at COCC focused on healthcare. I didn't put our culinary math on there, but we do kind of step in. But all of those courses are courses that students take. And just to give you a sense of this spring term, 2013, we offered 94 sections of math, the whole spectrum. 65 of those sections were below 100. 69% of the math offerings at COCC in this one term were developmental education math courses. So it just gives you a sense of, and then only 29 sections were 100 and 200 level courses. So you can, oh, can you move on first?
Jennifer, yes. Which of those courses are transferable for college credit?
So that's an interesting question.
Oops.
Math 111.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. However, when you talk about CTE programs, career and technical education programs, many of them require only Math 60 or Math 85 at our college to get your certificate or degree. Mm-hmm. And so it's an interesting conversation, but 111 is a transferable course.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dean Newby, thank you for traveling over the mountain today. It's
no problem.
A beautiful trip. Because COCC, your geography responsibility is significant. Do you offer these classes at other locations? And I know that COCC's enrollment has been the most significant. And how about your enrollment in this particular program?
Yes, we offer these courses at all of our campuses, with the Bend campus being the oldest and the most developed, Redmond being our second most developed, 12, 13, 14 years old.
Redmond.
And we added two new campuses this year. So we offer the full range across the district, including Adult Basic Skills non-credit courses.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And for the whole panel, any of this online, or any of these classes online, are you looking at online? But because I expect a lot of your students maybe be working or have children and things like that.
Yes, we do offer writing online and some math online.
Mm-hmm. One thing we find, though, is our students really struggle in the developmental area online. They need that additional support.
Mm-hmm. The face-to-face support.
Face-to-face, yes. Mm-hmm. We've been looking at what our outcomes are online, and they're very low. Mm-hmm. So we're stopping some of the courses at our lowest level online.
And to add to that, we don't offer any of our developmental education math or writing courses online. It's all the 100 and above, mm-hmm. just to clarify.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the question.
Yeah, although, Susan, those brush-up courses that you mentioned, some of them could be offered online,
oh, yes.
Right?
Yes, we're working on that component. Yes.
As the students are contemplating coming back to school,
yes.
where they could brush up and then do that from home.
Yes, that and the sort of new trend with flip class, mm-hmm. you know, targeted work, both at home and face-to-face if needed. So.
Yes. Thank you. Jennifer, could you wrap up, or are you?
Yeah. We can just. I just wanted to show you the writing courses, and let's get to the next one. The last thing I just wanted to talk about is this is sort of the biggest thing that we've done at COCC, which is the math redesign courses of Math 60 and 65, and we had two things happening at COCC. We had a massive enrollment growth over the last 5 years, and at the same time, we were seeing that our students weren't being as successful in our developmental courses, and so what we did is we redesigned two of our developmental math courses, and we went to an Emporium model, which is spending part of your time in lecture with an instructor and part of your time in a math lab with math software. And as you can see, we've played with it a little bit over the last couple years. It is still really new. We've only had it going on for 2 years, but within three terms, we were back. If you could go to the next slide for me, we were back to our original percentage of successful completion, which is a C or above, and we're anticipating that the success rate is just going to continue to get higher. The other things that happened for us was that we were able to serve many more students by allowing us to offer more courses because of the way that we designed the courses. And then just some byproducts of the redesign model is that students are completing the modules within the courses much faster. So we're now talking about how do we allow them to move more quickly to the next level instead of getting stuck in the 11-week time period. Increase computer literacy skills and just learning how to learn. It's putting the learning back on the students in a lot of ways. And I think, and I just have one last slide that you can just look at, but this just gives you a sense of the sections that we are offering and sort of our response to enrollment growth, and then the number of sections that we've offered in Math 60 and 65 over the last 5 years.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Shireen, welcome.
Good morning. My name is Shireen Wimbley-Govea. I see some hand signals happening there, so sure. I don't know how to...
I did have a question.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Just a quick question. I want to go back to the transferability issue. If you look at a degree audit report, mm-hmm. Math 105 is considered transferable, but
yeah. mm-hmm.
you said 111 was. Mm-hmm. Is that... No, am I wrong on that, or is that...
Mm-hmm. No, it's interesting.
Because it's 100's the base, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, great. Just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
And if I may add something to that before I get started. So Math 111 is what's called college algebra, and some of you look like you haven't been in college for a while, so you might have forgotten.
Hey,
it.
Hey now.
Yeah. You'd be developmental. Math 105, yeah. although I don't know the correct title at the transfer label level, is for students who are not going into what you call STEM majors. They're not going into science, technology, engineering, or mathematics. And granted, America and Oregon needs more students in those majors, but it's 85% of our students aren't going into those majors. So Math 105, which teaches them how to think quantitatively, which you need in business or in the workforce, is the appropriate class for them.
Mm-hmm.
Hope that helps. Again, good morning, Representative Dimbro and members of the committee. I'm Shireen Wimbley-Govea. I'm a faculty member, a little delighted and a little terrified to be here, but I hope I'm very enthusiastic. I think that's what everybody else would say. I come to you with two perspectives. One is I'm president of the Northwest Association for Developmental Education, and I'm also a co-member of the Northwest College Reading and Learning Association, which has over 100 faculty members who are also equally interested in this topic. But that's not why I'm here today. I'm here as a representative for my college. The first thing that I'd like to say is that we've been thinking about this issue since 2011. Our college president, Dr. Greg Heyman, has put forth an initiative, and I think most of us can spell it out, and it is increase student completion by 50%, ensure that our completion rates are demographically representative of our district, and ensure that when students complete, they can have a better life. They can have well-paying jobs.
jobs, which in turn translate into a betterment of the economic situation in our district and to increase the tax base of the state, just so you know. So, not numbers here, but visual aids. What do our data say? Well, our data say that that LBCC instructors do a good job compared to other Achieving the Dream schools. We're an Achieving the Dream school in getting our students to attempt our college math courses. Sounds great. Looks good. The red is good. The blue is better than the red, and that's what we like to see. It also shows that in developmental English, which are basic English, working at the sentence level all the way through the medium essay level, we do pretty good. Blue is good compared to counterparts throughout the United States. Well, that all looks good, and statistics can be used very many ways, but the fact of the matter is not very many, a large percentage of these students who are doing so well actually finish the gateway courses. So we've been involved in a major self-study over the past couple of years, and we know based on 40-40-20 and the Completion Act and all of that, we have to do better, faster, and with fewer resources. We absolutely know that. And so we have been analyzing how we are using our resource, our fiscal resources, our faculty resources, and we've looked at data, national and local, and we have become informed about best practice trends. And there's a term up here that's called scalable. Maybe you, in background in business, know what scalable means. But we can have beautiful suggestions of things to do, but if we can't apply those to many of the students in an affordable way, then, oh well, we're going to have to find something else. And the final thing I'd like to say is we've just gone through a major college redesign, complete redesign, to make sure that we achieve these strategic initiatives. We haven't finished, but we're on the way. So there are many, many things I could tell you about that we're doing that provide the context for improvement of developmental education, but I only want to address a few. The first, there's a group working on what we call foundational solutions. Foundational solutions are the students that my colleagues at other campuses have mentioned. They've been out of school for a long time. We are in no way going to diss what happens in K through 12 because a lot of things have happened to our students. They are the lowest, most vulnerable, lowest economic base. They are very vulnerable. They haven't had good experiences in school, but they're back because they believe school can give them a brighter future. And so the first thing, like was expressed, is we have to make sure that our placement is accurate. Some of you are members of professional organizations. If you go to higher education, maybe you had to take the graduate record examination. Maybe in your profession there's another kind of test that gives you a certification or makes you can put letters after your name as being proficient. Would you take that test without studying in advance? Probably not. The first problem with our placement is that students take it cold, and that's ridiculous. So, I mean, we're just learning this, but we're going to reduce the numbers of students placing into DE by doing some of the things like letting them know it's a high-stake course, high-stakes test. This doesn't cost anything, but we are going to emphasize to students, prepare before you take the thing. The second thing that we're doing at LBCC is we're going to develop the ideal first term for students who test two or more levels below college ready. These are students who probably read at the eighth grade level. Now you go, oh, read at the eighth grade level. What does that mean? College requires a significant development of skills in and sophistication in analyzing those horrid textbooks that are written by PhDs that have lots of big words that maybe nobody will use. But you still have to know how to manipulate your way through that. And so we're going to have an ideal first term that helps them not only address and improve those skills, but work on college-level courses as well. The result is we'll have a first quarter schedule for most of our at-risk students based on a meta-major, again, something that they've chosen to do. Meta-major means that the class that they'll take will be applicable to one or more majors if they're planning to transfer, and to one or more CTE programs if they're choosing to get a certificate. So no wasted courses. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say.
Thank you. And Shireen, this is really fascinating, but I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up.
How many minutes? One?
Just a couple.
Okay,
a
couple minutes. Okay. Our third thing is we're foundational writing. We're going to streamline that curricula. We're going to go down from five terms, 1 year and two quarters, to about two terms to get you ready to college writing. This will mean a tremendous change from what is offered now. Writing 115 students will be taking writing 121. Writing 90 and 95 students will be taking another level. Our mathematics progression, tremendous change there. Bottom line, improved curricular design. We're going to have a math boot camp and a math fast track, allowing students to progress maybe a whole year's worth of remembering mathematics in one quarter. So that's pretty impressive. The last thing that I'd like to do as a shout out is that one thing that we need that will help us is access to data. In order to, one of the best trends for accurate placement is high school GPA. Right now, community colleges don't have access to high school GPA. And the second shout out I'd like to say is that we faculty need professional development that's low cost, relevant, and includes our significant number of part-time faculty. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Shireen. Thank you, all three of you. If there are no burning questions, I'd like to go on to the university people. But thank you very much. This is very, very exciting. Okay, our university friends, if you would come up. Colleagues, as they're getting seated, I want to say that Rep. Johnson and I, you know, heard a lot of mention of new cutting edge activities and remediation around the country. But you know, I'm pleased to see that all of them are being done here in Oregon.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, members
of the
committee.
Third time's
a charm, indeed. Hopefully for your sake the last time. My name is David McDonald. I'm the Associate Provost at Western Oregon University. With me are two really well-respected and very experienced colleagues. Moira Dempsey is at Oregon State University. In addition to her 20 years' experience as a professional, she also has the distinction of being an alumna. So she's truly a Beaver through and through. And to her left is Dan Fortmiller, who despite his youthful appearance has 27 years of experience at Portland State, including starting their campus tutoring program, and he also developed their advising center. I'm going to begin a little bit with some broad-based pieces, and then finish with the Western Oregon University examples and turn it over to my colleagues. A quote that I think really helps frame how the universities approach development education actually came to me from Moira, and that is she's a member of the National Association of Developmental Education, and their quote is simply, helping underprepared students prepare, prepared students advance, and advanced students excel. And I think that really encapsulates one of the major distinctions between how universities, our role in the developmental education cycle versus our colleagues in the community colleges. At Western Oregon University, as an access-focused university, we take great pride in taking students from Oregon, from where they are, to where they need to be a graduate and a member of our society. We have really identified a number of issues that affect developmental education, some of which have been addressed, but they also include affordability. Students who can't afford to go to school full-time typically have to make compromising choices about what to prioritize even before they enter a university study. Academic success is another piece of that. How prepared were they in high school or the community college experiences? Socialization and transition. As a university that focuses on first-generation students, many of them come in lacking the social capital to even understand how to navigate their way through advising and tutoring and prerequisites and general ed requirements and all that vocabulary that is germane to a higher ed experience. Academic advising, and then data collection, analysis, and utilization. To give you just one data point I'm proud of, and I wouldn't be giving you a presentation if I didn't have data somewhere in my talk, is that at Western Oregon University, our Latino students actually have a higher graduation rate and a higher retention rate than do any other ethnic group on our campus. It's not accidental, it's very intentional, but it also takes a lot of concerted effort across the campus. Focusing on two things that we've done that we consider to be fairly innovative. The first is around mathematics, and it's a common theme we've heard today is math and writing are key stumbling blocks for students. Oftentimes, that stumbling block is from an atrophy of math skills. If I had all of you take a Math 111 quiz, even though you're quite educated and very learned, many of you would stumble on things that you've forgotten over time. things that you mastered 10 years ago when you were in high school or 20 years ago, whatever that time frame may be. We have that same issue at the university level. So we've looked at our math, and we've actually changed our placement practices from using a standardized national exam to a different methodology that builds into it math labs that are self-paced, which would allow students to complete math 60 and 90, not in two consecutive terms, but in a single term, if indeed they had just minor areas in which they needed to kind of brush up. They forgot how to do mixed compound fractions, which most of us would like to forget very quickly. Again, these are things that oftentimes will stumble or trip a student on a placement process and prevent them from moving to the next math class. It could be something that could be addressed in a two-week window rather than an entire 10-week term. So using ALEX, which is a math-specific software system, and the tutorials that go with it, we're putting students in self-paced classes, saving them time and money and allowing them to compress instruction into a shorter period of time. In addition to that, we've just introduced a policy change that would require our students to take math within the first 2 years of college study. If you have math anxiety, one of the things you do is you continue to delay taking math until the very end, which, again, increases the amount of math you've forgotten. So we're trying to change behavior by getting math taken care of from the front end of the student's study period as opposed to a delayed pain-type process. The other part that I'd like to address is our new Wolf Connection system. What we find is students have developmental needs that manifest themselves at different points in time along their academic pathway. Not all needs are identified as incoming freshmen. Sometimes a student doesn't discover they have a problem until sophomore year, junior year. And we've developed a system which allows the faculty and other staff to identify students who are at risk and get them to the attention we can provide them in terms of remediation, one-on-one tutoring, sometimes it's counseling, all the things about life that kind of get in the way of success. We try to identify and have someone centralized who can then do the referral or the one-on-one counseling that a student needs. And oftentimes, it's a combination of academic and non-academic issues, but you can't disconnect the two. You have to address them holistically. I'm going to now pass baton to my colleagues who will talk specifically about initiatives at Oregon State University and Portland State University in general.
Welcome, Moira.
Thank you. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, my name is Moira Dempsey and I direct the Academic Success Center at Oregon State. The number of students in developmental courses that are below 100 at OSU is very, very small, quite likely due in part to the fact that OSU has degree partner agreements with community colleges around the state. So that enables students who may need some developmental coursework to take it at the community college while being dual enrolled. So given my colleague's broad definition of developmental education, that's certainly what we adhere to at Oregon State University. So we've undertaken a robust agenda for serving students at various levels of preparedness from the beginning of their time at OSU and through graduation. And all of this has been under the direction of our Associate Provost for Academic Success and Engagement. Our signature academic support programs include supplemental instruction, academic coaching, academic success skills classes, the Math Learning Center. We have a wormhole, which is physics help, and we have a mole hole, which is chemistry help. So those are a few of the places that students, as they progress in the university, can go for assistance. We have two exciting new initiatives on the horizon. Fall of 2013, OSU will be ushering in a live-on requirement for our first-year students entering the residence halls. We know from the national data that students who live on in their first year have a much higher persistence and graduation rate. What we aim to do with this new requirement is to enhance the learning environment in the residence hall, providing living learning communities, academic coaching and tutoring in the residence halls, academic programming. Our second initiative is doing the same kind of enhanced learning environment, but in our cultural centers. So we're going to appoint a professional faculty member to each cultural center who will provide the same kind of initiatives as we're doing in the residence halls. Any student can use programs in the cultural centers, but many of the students naturally are attracted to their familiar community, and many of these students are what you might term at risk or underprepared, so we'll be catching them in that net, in that familiar community. I'd like to just take a moment to highlight our supplemental instruction program. I think the work students do in the classroom is paramount to their success, and supplemental instruction is a co-requisite program in which we identify high risk, high enrollment, general education, and gateway courses. Students can then select themselves into the support program. The SI leaders that run the study tables for students in these programs are highly trained in facilitating learning, so they help the students on a weekly basis with what they need to know for that week and also how to learn it. We determine which courses are at risk by identifying the DFW rates. If the rates are specifically high in a certain class, that's where we'll go in with support for supplemental instruction.
DFW?
Yeah.
D and F as letter grades, and W is withdraw.
I remember those.
Currently, we're serving students in Math 241, 251, and 252, the Bio 211 series, Anatomy and Physiology, and we'll add Physics next fall. Just a few data points. In general, across the courses and as a result of SI, we see a decrease in those DFW rates. For example, in Math 241, the DFW rate is 20% lower for students in the SI program than for non-SI students. On the other end of the spectrum in biology, we're looking at our pass rates. Bio has a pass rate consistently 90% for SI students as opposed to 80% for non-SI. On average, SI students receive one-third to one-half a grade higher than non-SI students, and this is especially important for students entering professional programs where they need a specific standard for their program. Perhaps more importantly, our demographic data show that a higher percentage of U.S. minorities are self-selecting into supplemental instruction, and that results in an overrepresentation of students who are often considered underprepared. A program like supplemental instruction serves high achievers and underprepared students alike, so it's one of the nets we're casting at OSU. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Moira.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. At Portland State, a third of our students come
could
to
Could you
us.
Identify yourself?
Oh, Dan Fortmiller. Associate Vice President for Academic and Career Services. A third of our students come to us as freshmen. Two-thirds come to us as transfer students or returning students. So it's a very diverse population that we serve. We don't really talk about remediation, developmental education at the university, much in the same way that our colleagues are talking about the breadth of how we're trying to serve our students. We do have a presidential initiative on student success to help all students to be successful. And I think I'll target, we have a portfolio of student success initiatives as there's not one fix, as you said earlier, cookie cutters or other things. There's not just one way in which we can provide our students some support, so I think I'll identify the two I think that are very salient right now in light of the time. 2 years ago, Provost Roy Cook made an internal investment of $1 million to enhance academic advising at Portland State, allowed us to hire 13 additional professional advisors and to place those advisors in the schools and colleges where the students obviously exist. The intentional model and this added capacity of advising really allows us then to implement intentional advising. We can require our students to attend a new student orientation, whether that's a freshman student or a transfer student, and we have separate sessions to address the different needs of those students, and they meet with their faculty and prepare for their first academic program their first year. We're also now requiring all of our first-year students to meet with a professional advisor or a faculty advisor at least one time in their first year to continue to work on the work that they did at their orientation program. Allows us greater intentionality there. The added capacity in advising allows us to case manage our conditionally admitted students. So those students who do come to us, perhaps missing some of the subject content in high school that was required, or perhaps coming with less than the 3.0 GPA that we require of a high school student, allows us to still target our access mission, but it allows us also to make sure that those students who are going to be working with an advisor to be supported in their endeavors. We purchased a customer relations management software program so we can do targeted messaging to our students. We do campaigns at different times of the year when they are developmentally ready actually to hear the messages about when should you go see the career center, when should you see your faculty advisor, if a student is on academic warning or probation, we can do some targeted messaging in terms of that. We're able to implement a freshman retention project where we have all of our freshman students take a prior learning survey where they indicate some of their concerns about going to the university, whether that's financial, social, or academic. And then we can have that information pushed out to all of our advisors who can do outreach to those students and target, again, the conversations and the connections in terms of the services that we have for our students. And finally, we're also able to now, we do our last mile committee, which allows us to go after and identify students who have applied for graduation but have left. And many of you have heard about that program and the success of us being able to help those students. We have implemented math prerequisite and placement along the lines of what you've heard for a lot of people. High failure rates in our calculus class, which many students must have to be able to be an engineering student. Almost a third of the students jumping into that class because that's the first class that's required for engineering, even though they might not be prepared for that. They're no longer allowed to do that. They do placement. They get the kind of support to be able to start appropriately. And then I really wanted to target, finally, one of the things that we just launched, which is our four-year degree maps and milestones project, where we have now mapped every single academic major at Portland State to not only the requirements for the major, but the requirements for the degree, whether that's a BA or a BS, as well as general education requirements. That information has been available in a catalog, but scattered throughout a catalog. It's now available in one spot on one website, so a student can literally see, if I'm going to be an engineer, if I'm going to be a sociology major, this is what a four-year map would look like to do that. We think this is very beneficial not only for our own students, but also for the high school counselors and the community college counselors who can look at the degree maps and help their students prepare in terms of their transitions. We've also asked each department to place milestones in that map so that we can identify if students go off track, that they're not making satisfactory progress, that they may declare themselves as a certain major, but they're not taking particular courses, we can then contact that student and say, you're a sociology major in name, but until you complete that statistics course, you're not going to be able to make satisfactory progress, and we can mine those maps to be able to do that. We've included on that website information about careers in each of these fields, as well as the learning outcomes that are expected from each of those majors, and we think this is going to be an extremely helpful tool for our students as well as our partners out in the community.
Thank you very much, Dan. And I assume you do outreach to them via email is how you
email
contact
and all
them.
Other social medias that we
yeah. Great. Thank you.
Any questions?
Okay. Thank you very much, all three of you, for coming and sharing with us, and everybody who came today for this. We've been waiting all session for this conversation, and I'm glad we're able to have it. Some more than others. So with that, I'm going to close this informational hearing on remediation in Oregon's colleges and universities. And colleagues, before I adjourn, we will be meeting at 8:30 on Friday. We will wrap up that apprenticeship issue, and we'll be hearing about athletics on Friday. Okay? And with that, we are adjourned.